current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. On the heels of NPR's Mount Everest story there, I'll point out that the Associated Press has tweeted news of a record-breaking base jump from Mount Everest. And base jumping is this this really incredible process. People jumping off bridges, fixed objects like bridges and peaks of mountains, jumping off them, parachuting to the ground, as opposed to from a plane. And apparently they've provided a link to a video of this record-breaking base jump from Mount Everest. May, of course, is the time of year when we hear about all of the activity on Everest, because the window of opportunity to climb Mount Everest in terms of the weather is just a couple of weeks in the month of May. So that is why there's all the flurry of Mount Everest activity. We have a good show for you coming up today. A little bit of Michigan history on the way with the story of the attack on Michilimackinac. You may remember this from your elementary school years, if not more recently. Kevin Lavery went up to Michilimackinac and filed a really cool story on the history of this battle. That is coming up. At the top of the show here this morning, though, a new five-year farm bill is making its way to a vote in the U.S. Senate. This is the second time in a year that the legislation has cleared the Senate. Michigan Democrat Debbie Stabenow, who chairs the Senate Agriculture Committee, says the House has promised to take up the bill in mid-June. The historic legislation would do away with crop subsidies farmers have relied on since the Great Depression. It replaces it with a strong crop insurance program. The bill's movement also coincides with an immigration reform package that may soon provide a legal framework for U.S. farmers to hire migrant workers. Senator Debbie Stabenow joins us now by phone to talk about the 2013 Farm Bill and other issues. Debbie, how are you?
Good morning, Mark. I'm doing well. I'm actually on the road at the moment. Yesterday we were crisscrossing the state talking with folks about the new farm bill, and actually it's a farm bill only reflects part of what it is. It's the largest investment in conservation that we make on lands, private lands owned by somebody, farmers or landowners or forests or whatever, and so there's a big effort to clean up the Great Lakes by dealing with conservation, erosion, pesticides, those kinds of things that are so important to us, and keeping the lakes clean, and nutrition and energy that we get from growing crops and using those instead of petroleum, and a whole range of things.
Yeah.
So it's all about jobs, though. You know, almost one out of four people in Michigan, they have a job connected to agriculture or the food industry. So it's a pretty big job creator for us.
You were all over the state yesterday. How much support for the bill did you encounter? How much resistance did you encounter?
Well, there's overwhelming support here in Michigan, because I've worked with all of the organizations, of farm organizations, as well as conservation groups, nutrition groups, so local folks interested in things like farmers markets and local food hubs, buying locally, all those kinds of things. And so there's overwhelming support. I think Michigan's on every page of this bill, no surprise, since I chair the committee. But it's gotten strong support. The problem was, last time we got it all the way through the Senate, the House committee, and then the Speaker of the House, first time ever, would not take it up on the floor of that House, and it died the end of the year, so we have to go back and do it all again. So hopefully they will understand how important this is as a jobs bill and a nutrition bill, and be willing to pass it this year.
The farm bill is historic for ending direct subsidies to U.S. farmers. Put into perspective for us why that's important and what the impact of that is likely to be.
Sure. Well, we've had a system in place that basically gives a government check depending on what you grow. And you may have high prices in good times, or it may be bad times, but either way, you got a government check. Doesn't make any sense in this age of, particularly when we need to be making tough choices and paying down the deficit. So I've said to folks, let's go back and look at everything, and does it make sense? Does it work? Does it duplicate other programs? And let's move to a risk-based system, meaning if you have a loss, if you have a risk, then we ought to be supporting our farmers. We have the safest, most affordable food supply in the world that because of farmers who are willing to take big risks in the weather, you know, the one thing we can't control, the weather. So we have a stake in this, but let's do it through insurance where we partner with farmers to make sure they have affordable insurance, and then there is no payout unless you have a loss, unless there's a disaster. So that makes a whole lot more sense than just giving subsidies. So by making that change, as well as doing a lot of other streamlining and consolidating, we're actually saving $24 billion in savings to pay down the debt.
Are you happy with what came out of your committee, though, and with the current debate in the Senate?
I am. I think that, you know, there's always a debate about whether or not we ought to be supporting farmers and ranchers. And there's some folks that want to dramatically cut help to families who need food help when they have their own personal disaster. But we've been able to keep this bill in good shape, balanced. It's got broad bipartisan support, and I'm very happy with the direction that it's going in the Senate.
The bill has also been criticized, and in some quarters very intensely. An economics columnist for The Guardian newspaper in Britain, Heidi Moore, calls it maybe, quote, the most harmful piece of economic legislation in America in years, unquote, for its food stamp cuts, the Vitter Amendment, and other features of the bill. Did you make concessions that you seriously disagreed with?
No, actually, I should say, and I totally disagree with that. I mean, as she may be wanting to talk about the House of Representatives that has done dramatic cuts in food assistance for families, but we have done nothing that gets in the way of someone who really needs help being able to get help for their family. We have gone after some fraud issues, though, and areas of abuse. You know, we've had a couple of folks in Michigan, at least, who won the lottery and were able to get food assistance, and obviously that's not what it was intended for. And we've had some retail fraud and other things. So we've tightened up on the fraud areas, and a couple areas of misuse, and been able to save about $4 billion by doing that while not touching at all the regular help and benefits that families get when they have an economic downturn. Now, the House has passed twice their budget over 10 years, which cuts over $130 billion in food help. In fact, block grants it to the states, cuts it, and then says you don't have to use it for food. So our effort to do some streamlining and cut $4 billion is exactly what ought to be done. We need to make sure we've got integrity in programs, that they go to folks who really need help, but that we're there when folks do need help, just like we're there for farmers. And crop insurance is there when there's a disaster for a farmer. Food help is there when there's a disaster for a family.
You said $130 billion in cuts to food stamps in the House, but didn't the bill that emerged from your committee include $20 billion in food stamp cuts?
No, actually, that's what the House did. It's confusing because there's a lot of different numbers. The House passed a budget with $132 billion over 10 years. The House Agriculture Committee cut $20 billion from food assistance. So we did not do that. They actually cut benefits, cut help. We didn't do that. So we've tackled some, as I said, abuse issues and saved $4 billion without cutting assistance to families.
Okay. No cuts in food stamps from the bill that emerged from the Senate Agriculture Committee.
Well, we have savings by cutting out some areas of abuse, but we do not cut the benefit levels for families.
Okay.
Right.
The Vitter Amendment, let's talk about that for a second. That would apparently prohibit food stamps for life to anyone convicted of a violent felony. You introduced that amendment, correct?
Senator Vitter introduced an amendment. We intend to fix that. It will not be in the final bill. It's something that needs to be you know, it has unintended consequences going forward. So we'll be working together to address the concerns there.
Tell us about the unintended consequences.
Well, the fact that it is a lifetime, even after someone has served their sentence, evidently would stop them somewhere in the future from getting help. So that's something that needs to be corrected.
One thing
if someone's in prison, it's another thing if they've served their time. So that's something that will be that we're working on some language to address it.
Do you think
it's certainly not a policy I support? It's not a policy I support. So.
But do you think the elimination of the Vitter Amendment would survive the Senate and the House and be signed by President Obama?
I'm sorry, the elimination of it?
I mean, if you eliminated or toned down the terms of the Vitter Amendment, would that clear the House?
If we eliminated it, it's not something that's been widely debated. It came up at the last minute, and I don't think it's something that's integral to the bill at all in the House or the Senate.
Ms. Moore of The Guardian also criticized what's called the Monsanto Protection Act, which she claims pushes genetically modified food at the expense of public health. There was also a demonstration at the state capitol here in Lansing over the weekend from people who are against the Monsanto, what's called the Monsanto Protection Act. Did you support or oppose that?
That's not in our bill. There's no bill called the Monsanto Protection Act, I don't believe, but we don't have anything in the Farm Bill related to this in terms of the FDA oversees safety and needs to make sure that they're monitoring and requiring labeling, or if there's a problem in terms of safety, that things are taken off the market. So I think what they're referring to is in the appropriations process last year, the House put in some language that folks that don't support genetically modified foods disagreed with. It was in the appropriations process. But we don't have anything in the Farm Bill that addresses that.
If half of what I read about the Farm Bill is true, I get the impression you could write a 1,000-page novel about this chapter, this chapter alone of your political career. How contentious has this process been?
Well, you know, there's always lots of different views, and truthfully, there's lots of different, sometimes misinformation about what's happening as well that you have to wade through. The good news is that we actually sat down and passed a bipartisan bill, so it came out of committee 15-5, and we'll pass the Senate next week with a strong bipartisan vote. So it's good for Michigan. As I said, we have done some historic things to promote conservation. Water conservation, protecting our lands, and a new Great Lakes Regional Conservation Initiative that's great for us. We're supporting all farmers, not just some. We make sure our fruit and vegetable growers, our small farmers are supported, as well as larger farmers, which is great for Michigan. And we do some things around promoting use of agricultural products and byproducts to replace petroleum in manufacturing processes, things that some of our car companies have been doing now for years. And if you own a Ford vehicle today and you buy a Ford vehicle today, you're actually sitting on soybeans in the seats because they're using soy oil for the foam rather than petroleum oil. So there's a lot of new ways that we can create biodegradable products that are better for the environment, create jobs for us, and get us off of foreign oil, and all of that's part of the Farm Bill.
Yesterday in Sparta, Debbie, you said you expressed doubts about the future of the Farm Bill in the House, where you referred to the Tea Party wing of the Republican caucus not believing a Farm Bill is even needed. Tell us more about that.
Well, I was asked about what the obstacles were in the House and why the Speaker didn't take the bill up last year, and I said it was because there's a group of folks that just say no to everything and don't think we ought to support farmers, even though they have the riskiest business in the world. that there shouldn't be crop insurance, we shouldn't have conservation efforts, we shouldn't have nutrition efforts, and so on. And so the good news is, though, I think there's a bipartisan group now in the House that's going to be able to overcome that. So I'm very hopeful.
Do you expect Gary Peters to join you in the Senate representing Michigan?
I'm sure hopeful he will be. He's terrific. He and I have worked both on the auto rescue and new technologies, and he's a great guy, a hard worker, very much focused on, he's all about Michigan and, fighting for the middle class. So I'm hoping he's going to join me.
Would you expect former Congressman Mark Schauer to prevail over Governor Rick Snyder next year if it indeed comes to that?
Well, I'm a big fan of Mark's. I think Mark Schauer is another person who's got the right values and perspectives, and he's going to do a great job, and I think he can win. I think he'll run a strong race, and again, worked with him on the auto rescue, worked with him when he was a leader in the state Senate majority, and very smart, a guy with a good head on his shoulders, and he's also all about Michigan, so that's good.
We're talking with Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow here on Current State. Some high-ranking members of your own party have recently had some worrisome things to say about the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Senator Reid and Senator Baucus both used a train wreck allusion to refer to possible funding challenges. How badly could states like Michigan hang up the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, actually, well, first of all, for folks who have insurance, most of the Affordable Care Act has already taken effect. Being able to keep your children on your insurance to age 26 or get preventative care without co-pays, and the idea that the insurance company now has got to spend at least 80% of their of every dollar you pay in a premium on medical care, and if they spend less than that, you get a rebate. A lot of folks got rebate checks last August, so most of that's taken effect. The big thing now is for minimum wage workers who would benefit in Michigan, and their small business employers would benefit if the state of Michigan adopted the expansion of Medicaid, which would cover minimum wage workers. That would help our small businesses and workers tremendously. And the new competition, the new pool that's coming into effect, is going to create more competition to lower rates for our small businesses. So my guess is there'll be some things that need to be worked on. I think the comments that were made were not that there would be, in fact, a problem, but that we need to make sure it's implemented and people have the information that they need so that they can we make sure it is implemented correctly.
But that Medicaid expansion, would you say that's crucial to its successful implementation?
I think it's very, very important, and I'm very, very disturbed that it looks like the legislature is not going to agree to move forward on this. This is critical for our small businesses. All of our small businesses that have minimum wage workers have the opportunity to potentially be covered under Medicaid. If not, the small business will incur the cost of health care coverage. And so it's very much a small business issue in Michigan. And I know that's why the Small Business Association of Michigan and the State Chamber have been very involved in advocating that the state accept what is 100% funding, that no cost to the state, that would help our small businesses and help our minimum wage workers.
We've been talking with Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow. Debbie, thanks for joining us here on Current State. We'll talk again soon.
Great. Good to talk to you.
WKAR, you're listening to Current State. Business and government policy aren't the only topics of discussion under the bridge this week. Memorial Day signals the start of the summer tourist season in Michigan, and the Straits of Mackinac is a traditional favorite for thousands of people. One of the area's top attractions is Fort Michilimackinac. French fur traders built the site in the early 1700s. It later became a British military outpost. Each year, locals reenact the era of colonial Michilimackinac, but 2013 marks an important milestone in its historic legacy. Current State's Kevin Lavery took a trip up north to learn more about the most dramatic event in the fort's history.
The native tribes who lived at the tip of the mitten were the first to see this geographic wonder where two of the five Great Lakes touch. In the 17th century, French fur traders ventured through these waters. By 1715, a crude timber-walled city had arisen on the shore. They called it Michilimackinac, the native word for great turtle. The Jesuits brought Christianity to this New World wilderness, and they established strong trade relations with the tribes. But France and Britain fought for control of these trade routes, and by 1761, the French turned Michilimackinac over to its old enemy. The colonists were allowed to stay and practice their Catholic faith, but the redcoats made it clear who was in charge. I came to call on the English infantry last Saturday to hear more of the story. At the commander's quarters, I met an officer in full dress who was queuing up for a Memorial Day march. I noticed that he bore a striking resemblance to Craig Wilson, the museum historian from Mackinac State Historic Parks. I could sense all was not well in the empire. Here in the spring of 1763, Wilson told me there was tension among the tribes.
The British government ceased giving gifts to Native American leaders. Gift giving is a very important part of Native American culture. They had come essentially to expect that as part of good relations. The British, as a cost-saving measure, decided not to do that. And that's just one of many, many things. There's widespread suffering in Native communities. There are crop failures. There are famines. There's epidemic disease all happening at the same time. So it's just one thing after another that leads up to this general discontent with this new British rule. They've replaced the French. They're not treating the Native people as well. And the Native people eventually said, we've had enough. And so Michilimackinac is just one of several forts that is attacked during the summer of 1763.
250 years ago, next Sunday, is the anniversary of the most dramatic event that's ever happened at the fort. What happened on that day?
On June 2nd, 1763, about 400 Ojibwa men began by playing a game of Bagadaway, or as we would call it today, lacrosse, just outside the fort walls. It was a very festive, very sporting atmosphere, but it was actually just a cover for a plan that they had to actually attack and capture Michilimackinac, which they eventually did. They tossed the ball near the gate, which was open. They ran over as if to follow it, and they just kept running. They ran inside. The women who had been watching the game passed out weapons that they had concealed beneath the blankets that they were wearing. So these men, hundreds of them, who are now armed, ran inside the fort and essentially began killing all the British soldiers that they could find. And within a few minutes, they were able to kill about 15 of the soldiers here. They captured the fort, and that's all part of something much larger that we know as Pontiac's Uprising today. Michilimackinac is actually the largest fort to be taken by Native forces during Pontiac's Uprising.
What physically happened after the uprising in terms of the Indian occupation of the fort?
They didn't necessarily occupy it. They had essentially killed nearly all of the British soldiers and taken the few remaining men as prisoners. They didn't stay here and garrison the fort or anything like that. And indeed, the local Odawa were instrumental in actually saving the remaining prisoners. There was some tension, at least if you believe the historic records, between the Odawa and the Ojibwa, who both live here. They both come up here and trade on a regular basis. The Odawa were supposedly unhappy that the Ojibwa had not told them this was going to happen, so they actually took in the remaining prisoners. In the meantime, the commanding officer who survived the attack appointed a man named Charles Langlade, who was one of the very prominent French-Canadian and also Métis residents, so he had both French and Native American parents. He appointed him as a temporary commander, and he actually oversaw the fort for most of the next year.
George III was the King of England at that time, and shortly after Pontiac's uprising, he issued a very famous proclamation. What was that, and why was that significant in colonial America?
It's the Proclamation of 1763. It happens too soon to be a direct result of the uprising, because that's signed just shortly after all this stuff stops happening. What it does is it formally recognizes this vast new territory that Britain had acquired from France. They had been in possession of Canada and most everything west of the Appalachian Mountains for about 2 years at that point, but they had never set up any sort of administrative structure. This finally did that, and it, at least in theory, tried to set up an Indian state. There are maps that specifically say lands reserved for the Indians west of the Appalachian Mountains. And the idea was if they could keep European settlement on the eastern side, they might be able to, you know, maintain good relations with the native people. They might be able to continue trading with them because the native people really are at the core of the fur trade. But as you might imagine, all these settlers out on the East Coast, this is just one, again, of many things that starts to lead to overall discontent with the British.
How is that part of America's history still vital, still relevant? How does it still echo today here in Michigan?
Well, you know, I think it's definitely apparent in places like this where we're trying every day to share that history with our visitors. I know for a fact it's a vital part of Native American communities. We've worked pretty closely with some of our local Native groups, particularly the Odawa, the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa. And I know that this heritage of Pontiac and this this idea of resistance and fighting to preserve their culture and their way of life is still very important. And they can trace that through Pontiac, through the American Revolution, through the War of 1812, all the way really up through modern times. So it is still there. It might not be in the places that you think, but the heritage of the uprising, of the attack, it is still very important.
Craig Wilson is the museum historian at Colonial Fort Michilimackinac, which is observing the 250th anniversary of the attack that was part of Pontiac's rebellion, June 2nd, 1763. Craig, thank you for talking with us today, and I'll let you get back to your official duties for the Crown.
All right, well, thank you.
For Current State, this is Kevin Lavery.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Current State's learned this morning that disbarred Lansing attorney Mark Kennedy pleaded guilty today to embezzlement between $20,000 and $50,000. This is in a tweet from the Lansing State Journal. Kennedy was accused of stealing $45,000 from the account of a young boy whose estate he was handling. So that is the latest on that front. Some pretty intense storms moved across mid-Michigan late last night. There was no missing that. And the Journal also reports today that at least residents in the hundreds in the area were without power this morning, according to consumers and DTE. It is Wednesday. It's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week we feature Charter House, which is a clubhouse for adults with mental illness. And here to tell us more about Charter House, Stephanie Tai, the clubhouse director. Hi, Stephanie.
Good morning.
And joining her is Nicole Wright, a member of Charter House. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you.
Stephanie, tell us about Charter House. What exactly do you do there? A clubhouse, it's referred to as.
Yeah, actually, the clubhouse movement, there are clubhouses in every country in the world. In Michigan, we have about 45. Charter House happens to be the first clubhouse in Michigan. And so a clubhouse is a place in our community where people who have a mental illness can come during the day. They can feel safe. They're not judged because of their mental illness. They can make new friends and learn new skills.
Anyway, tell us about the skills. Tell us about the other activities going on at the clubhouse.
Okay. When we begin our day with a morning meeting, and we believe that people who have a mental illness can function just as well as anybody. And so at Charter House, people lead the meetings, and our members lead the meetings, and we have several units. So we have a health department approved kitchen, so we make lunch for everybody. members answer the phones, make the copies, monitor the budget, everything it takes to run the program the members are involved in and
do. Okay. How many people do you serve?
We have about 35 people a day that attend, but we have over 600 members.
You're at this 7 days a week?
5 days a week.
Five days a week, mm-hmm. Monday through Friday.
Yep.
How do you people, I mean, what are there challenges for some of your members over the weekend then, or how does that play out?
Well, because we are a clubhouse, we're also open at least one Saturday a month. We're open holidays, and in the evenings we go out and do social activities together.
Okay.
So, and people connect with each other on the weekend.
I see. Okay. Nicole, when did you first start going to Charter House?
I started Charter House about 10 years ago, Mark. 10 years ago, I was isolated. I was my husband would make circles around me, coming and going back and forth to work. It was very excruciatingly painful to been isolated. So then I decided at that time when we moved from an apartment to a home that I no longer wanted to be isolated in that home. So I reached out to my case manager at Clinton Eden Ingham Community Mental Health, and we did a person-centered plan, drew up a plan about setting goals, and one of my goals was to start Charter House. And I did that. It was rough in the beginning. I had to learn a lot of names. I had to do my work, but I'm grateful that I continue with Charter House. It's been 10 years now.
How has it helped you? Well, tell us about the challenges at the beginning, the adjustment you had to make.
The adjustment is coming from isolation to being around people again. There's a barrier there that I have to learn to get over, and I had to learn about the other members, learn their names, learn what they were like, learn my tasks, adjust to being in the community again, away from the isolation, and that really took some work. But the Lord blessed me to be able to do that.
Was your problems socializing or challenges socializing? Were those part of a diagnosis then?
Yes, some of it, yeah.
Okay, uh-huh. A mental health diagnosis.
Right.
Stephanie, how long have you been at Charter House?
9 years.
9 years. Are there any stories that stick out in your mind that highlight why you do what you do?
Oh, boy. There's about a million stories, but I was just thinking when I was listening to Nicole, we have one woman who, she literally cried the first day she came to Charter House. Her family made her come. She was very, very depressed. And she did not want to leave her home, much like Nicole. So she came in tears the first day. And within a year, she was working. She no longer struggled with that depression. And now she has a job out in the community. And she's happy and she's wonderful.
Is there a pattern then where people like you, Nicole, become isolated and then reintroducing yourself back into society is a very serious barrier.
People who have a mental illness are stigmatized. You know, it's like when you hear somebody has a mental illness, you might think, ooh, are they violent? Are they going to hurt me?
Mm-hmm.
And so they do get very isolated. A lot of people have been estranged from their families and they have no one. And so coming from that isolation to a place where there's lots of people that are talking and bustling, and if you walk in the door at Charter House, people are going to meet you. Hi, how are you? What's your name? And
did you feel stigmatized at first, Nicole?
I didn't feel stigmatized at Charter House. I had some self-stigma going on. But at the Clinton Eden Ingham Community Mental Health System, I learned dialectical behavior therapy skills, which are a form of cognitive behavior therapy. They gave me coping skills to deal with intense, overwhelming emotions and feelings. So that step helped me to be able to take the next step, which was starting Charter House.
So it's a step at a time kind of thing.
Yes,
it is. Can you talk to us about the most important coping skill that you learned?
Well, a very important one is radical acceptance. Radical acceptance is where you try to accept things, even if it's painful or you may not agree with it or you may not like it. But you do your best, you take a step forward to try to accept it, and you keep trying to accept the situation as best as you can, rather than rejecting it, pushing it away, and causing more harm and pain and confusion. I would like to say that Charterhouse has helped my recovery just as much as Clinton Eden Ingham Community Mental Health System has helped my recovery. I've been married 18 years. I've been a homeowner for 11 years. I've also have worked for the past 10 years since being a part of Charterhouse. I've been sober for 23 years. I've been a non-smoker for 11 years. And I have committed no self-harm for 16 years, and I haven't been back to the psychiatric hospital for 20 years. That's evidence-based practice, which Stephanie will talk about.
Where is Charterhouse? Where is the clubhouse?
It's right downtown on Shiawassee Street. We have a bus stop right in front of the building.
And what's it been like working with the neighbors? Because, I mean, NIMBY kicks in at some point, not in my backyard, you know. What has that been like? Have you generally been accepted down there, or has there been tension?
I think generally we've been accepted. We don't have a lot of interaction. We've had an open house that we've invited our neighbors to so they can learn who we are and what we do. But I think for the most part, it's been trouble-free.
Where does your funding come from?
Medicaid.
Nicole, if people want to become a member of Charterhouse, how can they do it?
I believe we would like the community to know that there's a place of help for people who suffer from mental illness. They can come and grow and recover. And Charterhouse, our number, 371-2077, is there to help anyone who needs to recover from mental illness.
Have the recent shootings, school shootings, you know, a number of the people, the theater shooting in Colorado, you know, a number of the people who've perpetrated these things have been diagnosed with mental illness. That cannot help this challenge in terms of stigmatization.
It doesn't. And, you know, the members of Charterhouse, as soon as they heard about the shootings at Sandy Hook, they said it's going to be someone with a mental illness. Mm-hmm. We just know it. Mm-hmm. And they know that. But the members also talked, and they said, if that young man had been a member of a clubhouse, this would not have happened. He would have had a place to go. He would have had friends. He would have felt accepted. He wouldn't have needed to be scared about his symptoms or about maybe being hospitalized.
You're nodding, Nicole. You would agree with that?
I totally agree with that. At Charterhouse, we are like a family. We support one another. We care about one another. We help each other. And we take care of our own at Charterhouse.
I don't think I'd ever heard the term self-stigma before I just heard you say it a minute ago. What do you mean by that?
I mean that I've internalized from my culture or the community or the feelings about being mentally ill, a negative stereotype that you kind of pick up just by being involved, being a part of the community, growing up from a child to an adult.
Okay. Stephanie, do you look for volunteers?
We do.
How many volunteers do you have right now? How many would you like to have?
Well, we would like everybody to come and at least have a Charterhouse experience. We work a lot with students. We have a lot of interns, and we have volunteers mostly in the summer.
What's your background? Exactly. Professional background, otherwise work background.
I have a master's degree in social work, and I've worked with persons that have a serious mental illness since 1984.
You made some very good friends, I assume,
yeah,
at Charterhouse.
Yeah.
It sounds like a life-altering experience. Are these people it's easy to assume they're your family. They're like family.
That's true. They're like family. I trust them. Yes.
Yeah. How many other clubhouses are there in Michigan?
Michigan.
Then,
Stephanie? About 45.
45 altogether. Well, we want to thank both of you for coming in today. This has been very enlightening. Stephanie Tai is the director of Charterhouse, and Nicole Wright is a member of the clubhouse. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Current State.
Thank you for having us.
Current State could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there that are doing great work. We just don't know about them. And if you'd like to be featured on one of our Neighbors in Action segments, please send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. current state on 90.5 WKAR. Adam Woolsey grew up in Jackson with a musical theater goal in mind. After a couple of years working in New York, he's now a senior at MSU, and he's starring in the upcoming production of My Favorite Year at Riverwalk Theater in Lansing, a performance at the American Idol Experience at Disney World in Orlando. Earned Woolsey some national exposure in the form of auditioning for the TV show back in 2011. Current State's Scott Pohl talked with Adam Woolsey about American Idol and My Favorite Year.
Yeah, I was just fortunate enough to be there over the 4th of July weekend where they were doing like a special opportunity to send people directly to the actual audition experience. I was able to basically pick and choose where I wanted to go, and I kind of opted for the last chance audition in Houston, or it was technically Galveston, Texas, where I, you know, appeared in front of the judges with around 100 other contestants, and it was just an amazing experience. Just it's very different than it appears on TV, which I'm sure is not much of a surprise to anyone. It's just far more scripted than the audience gets to see. But it was just such a cool opportunity, one that I had never expected. I mean, I wasn't even planning on really auditioning or doing the experience at Disney World. I was pushed into it by my younger sister, and it just turned out to be one of the better or the best experiences performing that I've ever had.
Did you move beyond that stage then? I know that from the locations, like you say in your case, Houston, then they choose, I don't know what they call them now, but the ones that actually go on to Hollywood. Did you go on to Hollywood?
I did not go on to Hollywood, which was totally fine with me. Ultimately, becoming a pop star, pop sensation, was not in the plans. And you know, whatever I had had achieved up to that point was satisfactory for me. I was just excited to be there. I didn't take that as a sign of me not being good enough, but just maybe me not being what's right for reality TV at the time. I know that there are a lot of people who audition who are immensely talented, who go on to do great things, have great musical careers, that don't even make it on the show for whatever reason. So I just took it with a grain of salt, I suppose, and moved on from the experience.
Did you make it on the show?
From what I've heard, I don't personally watch the show, but from what I've heard, I did appear on TV. I received like numerous calls, text messages, when other forms of communication letting me know that, oh my gosh, we just saw you. So that's kind of the irony of the situation, is that I've never really been a fan. I've never watched American Idol, so I wasn't necessarily going to change that with the fact that I was on it.
All right, one final question about it. What did you sing in Orlando, and what did you sing in Houston?
So I kind of stuck true to the same thing. In Orlando, they have this list of songs that you can sing. It's not too limited. It's quite an expansive list. But I sang Drops of Jupiter by Train, which I was encouraged to sing through a vocal coaching session in Orlando. It's kind of crazy what they put you through there, but I just decided, you know, if that's what got me to where I was and that's what won me that competition, then maybe that's what I should stick with. And that's exactly what I sang in Houston. And I was told by the judges that it was quite impressive and that I clearly was very talented. They actually alluded to the idea that, oh, maybe you should do musical theater, or maybe you have a musical theater sounding voice. And I was like, well, that's great, because that's what I do. But yeah, I stuck with Drops of Jupiter, which just was a great song for me, and it's become sort of like a, I don't know, my parents seem to always remind me when it's on the radio or when they hear it, because it's just tied to memory with the experience.
So here you are at MSU. You're a senior now. It's summer. You're taking summer classes, and yet you're finding time, making time to appear in the Riverwalk Theater production of My Favorite Year. What drew you to audition for this show?
I auditioned for this show only knowing one song from the show. And it's a song that I had in my audition book in New York called Larger Than Life, which is just a really great song.
Uncle Morty used to send me to the movies. Here's a nickel, kid. Cheer up and go. And though I was only 7, I discovered heaven at the RKO. Blue lights, pink lights, stars in the ceiling, an organ as big as a Buick, and a screen as tall as the Great Wall of China.
So I kind of went into it thinking that, you know, I really only wanted one part, and I wrote that on my audition form that I wanted this part and nothing else, and, you know, I just seemed to work out. And I had worked at Riverwalk before on Spring Awakening last September, which was just a phenomenal experience, and the people there are so committed to the building, to providing great entertainment, and I just had such a wonderful experience that really half of the reason that I even went to audition for this show at all was because it was at Riverwalk. I'm so fortunate to be a part of the show, and I'm so fortunate to be cast in the role that I am.
Have you seen the movie version of My Favorite Year?
I haven't seen the movie, and I kind of went back and forth as to whether or not I should. I kind of wanted to make the part or the show my own rather than base it off of something that I'd seen. So, you know, I'm still kind of debating as to whether or not to watch the movie now that I've solidified what I'm going to personally do on stage.
There's lots of fun music in the show, but it's really, really funny. And the premise, for people who aren't familiar with it, is a young man who works on an old TV show. I say old, meaning 50s era, mm-hmm. if I recall the time frame correctly. And a big movie star has been brought in to appear as a guest on the show. In the film, it was Peter O'Toole, mm-hmm. who was magnificently drunk the whole time. And this young guy is in charge of straightening him out, keeping him sober, if that's even possible, for his appearance on the show. And mayhem ensues, as they say. Is the stage presentation of it similar in that regard to the film?
It is very true to the film in that sense. It's the same concept of a very big movie star who's kind of past his prime, comes in as a last second replacement. This movie star named Alan Swan happens to be the absolute idol for my character Benji, who grew up just adoring him and really viewing him as a father figure. Come to find that he is quite the alcoholic and has some demons of his own that and Benji is placed or is deemed responsible for him and in charge of taking care of him. There's a lot of comedy that surrounds around that particular storyline. There's also a lot of really tender, really strong emotional moments that come out of it as well.
There's a sweetness to it.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, Peter O'Toole played drunk magnificently. Who's in the part here in Lansing?
Mike Stewart is actually playing the part of Alan Swan, and I'll be honest, he plays drunk quite well. It's funny, but at the same time, it's, you know, everybody, us as actors, are kind of like how are you doing that so well? I mean, we're certainly not accusatory of anything, but. But he's just doing a phenomenal job, and he really brings such a large presence to the part, which it absolutely demands. It's so much easier to act alongside someone who is giving you so much of themselves and so much substance and so much depth to their character. It's just a pleasure every night to explore and to really have fun.
Riverwalk isn't the biggest theater. Is the orchestration live for the show?
It is live, and they're going to be sitting pretty high up. They'll be behind the actors, but they'll be on like very tall platforms. You're right. It's not a very big space, but they do wonderful things with what they have to use. And we've been working with our music director, James Greer, who's just been an absolute professional at what he does. And we're entirely confident that when the orchestra is included, that the show will just be brought to an entirely new level.
Adam Woolsey, thank you so much for stopping by, and good luck with My Favorite Year at Riverwalk Theater.
Thank you. I hope everyone that comes to see it enjoys it, and I, you know, appreciate the opportunity.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Coming up tomorrow here on Current State, we'll talk with MSU President Luana Simon. Also, we check in with State Senator Gretchen Whitmer, and we'll explore a unique show that harkens back to the Detroit music scene in the 1970s. All that and more Thursday here on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Becky McKendry for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.